U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry pushing today to secure a preliminary accord that would limit Iran's nuclear program. This hour, what would that deal really mean? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our international political analysts, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College and Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, join us to give us their take on negotiations in progress in Switzerland over Iran's nuclear program. Also, it seems countries in the Middle East are disintegrating. Yemen is the latest to fall apart. We'll ask Jim and Wayne what's happening and the big news in domestic politics, that backlash over Indiana's religious freedom law. Join our conversation. Politics Day starts after this news from NPR. It's Politics Day here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining me this hour are political analysts who have their eyes on the international politics of the day as well. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at the Iowa State University, joining us from our studio in Ames. Hello, Jim.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. And Wayne Moyer, joining us by phone, Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College. Wayne, always good to have you. Hello. Lots to talk about. And of course, when we have you two on, that means there's international politics developing, usually. Later in the program, we'll talk about Yemen. It seems so many countries in the last few months, years, are disintegrating. Yemen, the latest to fall. We're going to ask Jim and Wayne to tell us what's happening there and why we should be concerned. Then we'll switch in later in the program to domestic politics, of course, talking about the big buzz on in our country, the backlash over Indiana's religious freedom law. In fact, we want to reach out to you and tell us in five words or less via our social media, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Five words or less, answer this question. What do you think the backlash over Indiana's Religious Freedom Restoration Act says about what's changed in our country? Five words or less, go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page or tweet us at IPR Talk. Before that, we want to focus on the talks resuming in Switzerland today, an extension of the talks over Iran's nuclear program. Reports say that an initial accord is potentially within reach, but there's still much work to do. Nobody ruling out the possibility that these negotiations might extend into the week. Other participants include not only Iran and the U.S., but Britain, China, France, Germany, and Russia. A senior Iranian negotiator talking with Reuters today said that the deal has not yet been reached, but that negotiations regarding sanctions were continuing. Let's listen to what this Iranian negotiator had to say this morning.
We have a deal when all issues are resolved. There are unresolved issues at this moment which have not been resolved. We are concentrating on finding the best solutions which are mutually agreed by everybody. And these efforts would be continued until we have those solutions. So we do not have any artificial deadline. 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 9 o'clock. For us, the whole day can end in the next morning. So we are sparing no effort to find the best solutions.
And an Iranian negotiator in Switzerland talking today. Jim McCormick, let me start with you. What's your assessment of what's happening? How close they actually are to this preliminary agreement?
Well, that comment suggests that they'll continue the negotiations until they get some sort of an understanding, it seems to me. I think the deadline has been has been moved back. The goalposts have been moved down the field or something like that, whatever the appropriate metaphor is here, at least from the Iranian side. You know, these negotiations have already been extended at least three different times. So it sounds like that they're going to continue to be extended. I was interested in the comments about sanctions and so on, because, you know, I think that is a very important point for the Iranians. Of course, they want a quick lifting of the sanctions, and the Western powers that are negotiating, or the P5 plus one that are negotiating with Iran, would like, I think, a slower set of lifting of the sanctions to maintain compliance, as well as at least a French position, as I've seen announced. They'd like a much more ability to reimpose the sanctions if there were violations.
Wayne Moyer, what do you see as we keep our eyes on the news out of Switzerland?
First of all, I think having a deadline is critically important. In any kind of international negotiations, it's usually only a deadline that causes anything to be done. In terms of the exact date, which has now been passed, I don't think that's critical. But if they're going to do something, they're going to have to do it in the next couple of weeks. Otherwise, the U.S. Congress is going to impose new sanctions. And then that will, I think, throw the whole negotiations into kilter if the Congress does that.
A few weeks ago, we saw that 47 Republicans in the Senate, including Iowa's Republican senators, Grassley and Ernst, sent an open letter to Iran's leadership warning about making a nuclear agreement with President Obama, a letter organized, written by Senator Tom Cotton, a freshman from Arkansas. Jim, do you see that as having changed as we come up to this first deadline for the preliminary agreement? Did that change the equation in any meaningful way, that letter and the actions of Congress? Of course, we had Netanyahu coming to speak before Congress.
I think what it has done, actually, at least a little bit that we hear coming out of the White House, is that they now are of the view that they've somehow got to sell this to Congress, and that may mean some sort of a resolution passed by Congress endorsing the deal. So I think that, at least the way I would read it, if we can tea leave reading a little bit here, I think that's probably been the consequence of the Cotton letter here. Given that the public opinion is still a little bit skeptical about Iran, and in that sense, the Congress has probably got public opinion on its side, and that I think that moves the administration to figure out some way to get at least a nominal kind of approval from Congress. And I think Wayne's point is really on the mark that, you know, if this is not done in the near term, that gives even more ammunition to congressional opposition and maybe the imposition of sanctions here, although obviously the president could veto it. Although one report said they have now maybe 63 senators that are willing to sign on to sanctions.
Mm-hmm. Talking about public opinion, the Pew Research Center issued a survey within the last few days. I think 1,500 Americans polled in this latest survey. Americans approving by 49%, more than disapproving 40% of the U.S. negotiating with Iran over its nuclear program. But, and this goes to the point that you just mentioned, Jim, the public remaining skeptical of whether the Iranian leaders are serious about addressing international concerns over their nuclear enrichment program. So Wayne, the Iranians do not want the sanctions on them anymore. So the talks over how to, under what conditions to release or ease the sanctions, what are the more nuanced parts of the negotiations over Iran's nuclear capability?
Well, I think there are a number of issues. And I think, by the way, that President Obama will, to sell his agreement, will have to come up with an agreement that has a lot of specifics in it. Otherwise, it's going to be very hard to sell. Okay, some of the issues are, and how extensive will the inspections be? Will we be able to inspect Iranian military bases, which I think has been quite questionable up until the moment? How long will this agreement last? If we do end sanctions, how fast? And then if the Iranians violate, then what kinds of penalties? Where do they send their enriched uranium? What kinds of limits do we put on their research? It seems to me these are all very important issues that will have to be, in one way or another, addressed with some degree of specificity in order to sell the agreement.
Mm-hmm. Israel not directly involved in these talks. The U.S., Britain, China, France, Germany, Russia, in talks with Iran. But, of course, the Israeli prime minister making lobbying Congress, being very loud, lobbying Congress personally at the invitation of Speaker John Boehner. They are against any deal with Iran, Jim McCormick?
Well, I think Prime Minister Netanyahu said that this was a bad deal, so this deal, he's opposed to this. I don't think that he would say that he would be opposed to any deal, but one of the things that the Israelis have always been concerned about, although Netanyahu didn't necessarily mention it in his speech to the U.S. Congress, was that there be dismantling of some of the infrastructure. That has seemed to be put aside in this negotiation. There doesn't seem to be any dismantling, at least that I've seen about. One of the things, of course, has been most critical here is the Iraq facility in which they can reprocess plutonium here, and you know what is done about that, and what kind of strictures would be put on that facility. So, I think unless there were some if you will, dismantling of some facilities, that would be where the Israelis could sort of cheer an agreement that was being negotiated.
Wayne, anything to add to the Israeli position? Thoughts?
Well, I think Netanyahu is operating under the assumption that if the negotiations fail and sanctions continue to be in place, that somehow or other Iran will be forced to make more concessions later. And it seems to me that that's a questionable assumption. One, will we be able to keep the sanctions in place? And two, since there's national pride involved for the Iranians, that even if we can keep the sanctions in place longer, can we expect them really to dismantle anything that they already have?
Mm-hmm. We hear a lot. Jim, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I think that the national sovereignty question, the sort of the nationalism sentiment that would arise, it's already obviously taken place to endure the sanctions that have been in place now for almost 2 years, the more severe sanctions, at least for almost 2 years with the Europeans and so on. So I think that will additional sanctions probably will not be the sort of much of turning the screw and really making the Iranians make more concessions here.
How important is this deal for President Obama, his legacy, his presidency, his second term, Wayne Moyer?
I think it's very important. I think the fear that Obama has, and I think a lot of us have, is if these negotiations fail and Iran continues with the program, that there will be very strong pressures to use military force in order to try to destroy the program. And I don't think that will be easy and may well mean that we would have to try to overthrow the Iranian government. And I think that's a fear that Obama is going as far as he can to try to avoid.
We listening to a lot of press reports, reading them, you might think this is just in a negotiation between the U.S. and Iran. But it does involve these other countries, Britain, China, France, Germany, Russia. Jim, give us some perspective on these other countries' interests in these talks. For instance, China's perspective.
Well, I guess my take would be that China is not unhappy that the Americans are sort of and the Europeans are kind of tied down with the Iranians and what the Iranians might do, because, of course, it gives them considerable more latitude in terms of operating within the international system. I don't think ultimately that the Chinese are interested in having another competitor with nuclear capabilities here, but I think in the short term it gives them some, if you will, political leverage, and it gives them advantage in terms of, you know, the Obama administration has said they're going to turn and pivot towards Asia. Of course, that has become largely a misnomer as the Middle East has continued to be a hotbed of unrest, and of course with the Iranian talk. So I think China in the short term sees this to their advantage to kind of keep this kind of percolating and without an agreement. But the long term, view would be that they certainly do not want Iran to get a nuclear weapon.
Could I just add a little bit to that? China, of course, imports a lot of oil from the Middle East, and the prospect of increased instability in the Middle East, to the extent that it could endanger the oil exports to China, I think would be a matter of concern to the Chinese.
Mm-hmm. And Russia's role in these talks, their perspective?
Well, I think Russia also has said numerous times that they do not want Iran to get a nuclear weapon. And, of course, just the looking at the geography here with the closeness of Iran to Russia, that would be a certain kind of imperative for them not to have an adversary or potential adversary close to their borders here.
Mm-hmm. What about Britain, France, and Germany as our NATO partners? Is there daylight between the European and American positions in any way?
My sense is on that the Europeans have a huge stake in the negotiations. And I think that increases Obama's stake in the negotiations. And, of course, the Europeans import a great deal of oil from the Middle East as well. So And the Europeans, I think, would not under any circumstances want to use military force and would essentially putting all of their cards in the negotiations.
Okay. Yeah,
I think the use of military force, you know, that would even get these other, you know, if you think of the P5 plus one, there would be really five of those would really be opposed to any kind. I mean, the Chinese and the Russians surely would be opposed. And as Wayne said, the Europeans as well.
Okay. Let's pivot over to Yemen. No shortage of disintegrating countries in the Middle East, and Yemen is the latest to fall apart last week. Saudi Arabia started bombing positions of rebels in Yemen. We don't hear much about this country. Other groups joining the fighting since the Saudis started their bombing. Jim, can you tell us what's going on? Who is fighting whom?
Well, there's really a... In some ways, this is kind of a surrogate conflict, if you think of it, in a larger kind of geopolitical concerns here between Saudi Arabia and Iran, because Iran, of course, is backing the northern elements in Yemen, the Houthis here, and Saudi Arabia is supporting the Sunnis in the south. And in some ways, it's kind of a standoff between those two. I mean, there is this kind of sectarian division coupled with this kind of geopolitical division. And given the, at least what I would see as the strategic location of Yemen, it becomes important in terms of its access to both the Indian Ocean and the Red Sea. And I don't think that can be sort of dismissed as an important concern for the United States and for other countries in the region. It'll be interesting to see now that I noticed the president announced today that announced that he was lifting the restrictions on weapons to Egypt. And I would be interested to see how the Egyptians play out, because in the past, of course, the Egyptians have had an interest in Yemen.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, let me pose this to you. Why did the Saudis feel they need to get involved militarily?
Well, I think their sense was that the Houthis, the northerners who are Shiite, were getting support from Iran, and the Saudis are extremely uncomfortable now with Iran's overall attempt to increase its power in the Middle East and saw Iran on its southern border beginning to exercise power, and hence felt compelled to intervene. And this I find extremely troubling. I mean, this starts as a local conflict, then Iran gets in, now Saudi Arabia gets in, and I don't think any party has the power to win, and this whole situation could easily turn into anarchy, I think.
Mm-hmm. How does this fit into Yemen's disintegration, the entrance of the Saudi military, fit into the bigger picture of the widening of conflict in the Middle East? We have fewer and fewer countries in the Middle East, Arab countries that are not at war, Jim.
Well, you know, Yemen, of course, was sort of the focal point by the United States and by the Obama administration of this kind of anti-terrorism campaign. I mean, drone sites out of there and so on. And that sort of, with this kind of disintegration that has occurred, we've pulled out those special forces. Apparently, I don't know if it's been completely pulled out, but nonetheless, that was sort of the announcement here, and so that has reduced the amount of leverage, if you will, for the United States, and you go across northern Africa as well because you have problems in Libya as well, and so you got that whole sort of from the Fertile Crescent all the way across northern Africa, you got this kind of turmoil going on, and I think it's the case that the United States has to pick and choose particular groups to support because they have varying and differing kind of interests as you go from country to country in that region. So, there's been criticism that the administration doesn't have a coherent policy, but I think there are differing interests that they're really trying to protect.
Mm-hmm. Before we go to break, we've got a couple minutes. I was interested in you are watchers, analyzers of the situations around the world in terms of politics. Can you share with us, recommend reading for anyone who wants to get a better handle on what's happening in the Middle East, Jim McCormick?
Well, one piece that I've found really intriguing, particularly as we're trying to learn about ISIS, was a piece in The Atlantic. Actually, it's a March issue, but it came out in mid February or so on, and it was what ISIS really wants. I think it's a provocative kind of analysis of what ISIS is about and how is it different or similar to Al Qaeda, and I found that to be very, very educational in terms of getting a firmer understanding of the relationship between those two different Al Qaeda and ISIS, and also to get a little bit clearer of the sort of the religious underpinnings, the sectarian underpinnings of ISIS. So I think that was for me was a very very useful kind of source. I think the other source that I find week in and week out that's that I always don't get through, which I wish I would be The Economist. I think The Economist probably does. I don't have any shares in The Economist or anything like that. But in terms of just a kind of a holistic global view of what's going on in international affairs, I find both their weekly reporting and some of their special reports to be very, very comprehensive.
Wayne, but before we go, we have just a few seconds, but what sources do you turn to? Because source is important. We have information out there, and then we have spin out there, don't we?
Yeah. In addition to what Jim said, and the Graham Wood article is a great article, the Foreign Policy webpage sort of has daily sorts
right.
of things, and Council on Foreign Relations page also has a lot of information on the Middle East. So those would be good sources. As well as the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, etc.
Okay. I think we're going to put something like about that on our website when we post this program as a podcast. So if you'd like to find out more about that, look to iowapublicradio.org, find River to River. When we come back after a short break, we'll talk about the domestic buzz in terms of politics, the backlash over Indiana's religious freedom war. Now, Arkansas is getting into the game, if you can call it that. We'll talk about that when we come back. We want to hear from you. What do you think the backlash over Indiana's religious freedom law says about how our country has changed? Five words or less. Go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page or tweet us at IPR Talk. Back in just a moment. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News Politics Wednesday with Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College. The first half hour focusing on international political developments, but this half hour we're going to turn to domestic political news, specifically that backlash over Indiana's religious freedom law. We want to reach out to you. We've had several responses via social media. I want to ask you to chime in on our Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page or tweet us at IPR Talk. What do you think the backlash over Indiana's Religious Freedom Restoration Act says about what's changed in our country? Five words or less is the deal we're giving you there. Five words or less. What do you think this backlash says about how our country has changed? Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page or tweet us at IPR Talk. Today, Republican lawmakers in Indiana meeting with gay and lesbian groups as they rush to recraft a potentially discriminatory Religious Freedom Restoration Act, sparking national outrage over the past few days. Yesterday, Indiana's Republican Governor Mike Pence pledging to rewrite the law he rushed through last week. Here he is speaking at a press conference yesterday.
And let me say on the subject of the bill itself, I don't believe for a minute that it was the intention of the General Assembly to create a license to discriminate or a right to deny services to gays, lesbians, or anyone else in this state. And it certainly wasn't my intent. But I can appreciate that that's become the perception, not just here in Indiana, but all across this country. And we need to confront that, and confront it boldly in a way that respects the interests of all involved. This law does not give anyone a license to deny services to gay and lesbian couples. Clearly, there's been misunderstanding and confusion and mischaracterization of this law.
In an interview yesterday with NPR's Morning Edition, Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard criticized his state legislature for passing this Religious Freedom Restoration Act. He says that his city has worked very hard to build the reputation they have as a cultural center over the past few years, and the legislature needs to consider the law in context with the rest of the Indiana Code.
You can't take the law by itself. You have to take it in conjunction with the rest of the Indiana Code, and since sexual orientation and gender identity are not protected classes, then that is where the problem comes in. And you can see the effect throughout not just the city of Indianapolis, but throughout the state of Indiana. The business community is outraged. A large, large number of them are Republicans.
Okay, we're asking our listeners this half hour, what do you think via our social media, Facebook page, or our tweet us at IPR Talk. What do you think this backlash has says about how our country has changed? Bill tweets, discrimination is more covert today. Those are his five words. Craig tweeting, we must follow our hearts. Rob, Jim Crow is the past. Philip tweets, we've started rejecting irrational thought. Sonny tweets, we are becoming increasingly intolerant and self-righteous. Shane tweeting, discrimination is still strong. Your observations, Wayne and Jim, after that long prologue there. But this is an interesting controversy that's swelled up suddenly in the country. Wayne, your thoughts?
Let me start on this. We've had a national religious freedom law for years, but what Indiana did in its law, it added a provision explicitly stating that religious freedom applies to the exercise of religious beliefs can be applied by businesses as well as individuals and religious groups. So that would give, if you read that strictly, that would give business the right to discriminate against people who were not covered by other anti-discrimination legislation in their dealings with those people. And Indiana has no law protecting against discrimination based on sexual preferences. And so what immediately came to mind from this will allow businesses to discriminate against same-sex couples.
Mm-hmm. What about the claim by Governor Pence there? Misinformation, misunderstanding across the country. Do you take that at face value, Wayne?
I think this specific provision about the exercise of religious beliefs by businesses leaves it wide open in terms of what businesses can do, unless there is some specific anti-discrimination provision somewhere else in law.
Jim McCormick, should Governor Pence have expected what he got?
I think he probably should have anticipated it. It'd be hard to imagine that the legislators had not thought about the consequences that might evolve from this legislation. One of the things that I think the conversation has not been as helpful on is actually talking about what the law says. There's been a lot of, I was trying to get a real handle on what exactly the law says, but much of the commentary has immediately not really got into that discussion. So I think, you know, what Wayne is pointing out is helpful here, because we're really looking at exactly what the law says. And I think that that as that gets into the public arena, that will be, I think, very, very helpful to getting some kind of, really a balance here, because this is going to activate, it has obviously activated the LGBT community, but I suspect it's going to activate the religious conservative community as well.
I'm reading in the New Yorker an encapsulation of an article they have about it titled Why a GOP Gambit Backfired in Indiana. The New Yorker's take, the Indiana law is the product of a GOP search for a respectable way to oppose same-sex marriage and to rally the base around it. Wayne, do you see that?
Well, I think that's quite consistent with what I was saying a few minutes ago. This provision about religious beliefs by businesses sort of plays into that.
Mm-hmm. Today, Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson asking lawmakers to rewrite their controversial religious freedom bill that opponents say could also be used to justify anti-gay discrimination. Legal experts have said this Arkansas bill, like the bill that was enacted in Indiana last week, went further than federal law, could have given businesses a wider berth to discriminate. Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson announcing this morning in a press conference that he has asked his legislature to recall the bill, this one called the Religious Conscience Act. He says there will continue to be debate on the issue, but that he must take into consideration the concerns of business leaders in the state of Arkansas.
We have to, as a state, look for means to communicate that we recognize the diversity of our workforce. We are an international community in terms of housing the headquarters of international businesses here in this state, and we want to be able to compete in that market. So this is both about substance, which is getting this legislation right, and it's also about communicating to the world and to our neighboring states that we're a state that recognizes the diversity of the workforce, the need for non-discrimination, and that we want to accomplish that.
Okay, Governor Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas asking state lawmakers to rewrite their version of a controversial religious freedom bill. Going back to asking our listeners for their five words about what they think this backlash over Indiana's Religious Freedom Act says about the way our country's been changed via our social media. Ned tweets, cultural 1% dictates. Glenda tweets, old white men still alive. Ned, a second tweet, progressives own your conscience. Kurt posting on Facebook, conservatives distracted by money, fear. Mike tweeting, no tolerance for intolerance. Tara posting on our Facebook page, no freedom till we're equal. So we hear tweets there also reflecting various perspectives. I don't know, Jim, can you sum up what this says about how our country has changed? And it has changed dramatically in terms of not only laws, but attitudes towards same-sex marriage.
Well, I think the, towards sexual orientation, there's been over, two or three decades here, I think there's been a really dramatic change in terms of equality in terms of sexual orientation, and I think that is reflective in the kind of spontaneous reaction that has taken place. I mean, when you think of this sort of just this announcement of this Indiana bill within the past few days, but the demonstrations that have been taking place and the degree to which opposition to this bill has been activated, I think that says something very dramatic about the changes in American society.
Wayne Moyer, is it a fair criticism when people defend this bill and say this is something akin to what could have been enacted 10 or 20 years ago without any problem?
I doubt very much whether, if it had been enacted 10 or 15 years ago, they would have thought to add the provision about the exercise of religious beliefs by businesses. I don't think that was even something that people thought about at that stage.
Okay, so is that a consequence of Citizens United, where corporations and companies are people too with rights?
I think it's more it's more the Hobby Lobby case last spring that the Supreme Court decided, which essentially, if I understand it correctly, allowed the Hobby Lobby to essentially discriminate in terms of, I think it was healthcare benefits employees.
Yeah. Thank you for I meant to say Hobby Lobby, but you're right on that case, of course.
I think the real challenge here is how Indiana and I guess Arkansas are gonna fix this, because you know there's obviously a lot of vested interests in the current language of the bill in both states, it seems to me. Plus you have this business community. I mean, is it going to be just to change the one provision and that will be satisfactory? I suspect what we're really going to see is really a court challenge on this somewhere along the line, and probably all the way to the Supreme Court.
Challenge specifically with the question of what, do you think?
Well, the question is over the extent of religious freedom, it seems to me, is going to be the, you know.
How much does your religious freedom, is it allowed to come into my acquiring of services and goods?
Yeah, because the Hobby Lobby case, of course, was given individual status basically to corporations. I mean, this bill was written, if again, as much as I've seen of it, is written at the individual level, and I think that will be where the challenge will likely take place.
Okay, thank you very much to our listeners for your five words talking about how this backlash over Indiana's religious freedom law has changed our country. Interesting perspectives there. Let's move on to a couple things before our hour gets away from us. Far too many things always in politics to cover in 1 hour. But let's talk a little bit about this. A lot of focus on the GOP hopefuls for the White House. But here's something on the other side. The Democrats, three prominent liberal activists, including the president of a large union, calling for Elizabeth Warren to challenge Hillary Clinton for the Democratic presidential nomination, insisting that the Massachusetts senator's participation in a competitive primary process would benefit the party. Now, Warren still not budging from her insistence that she won't pursue a White House bid. Clinton expected to launch her presidential bid soon. Wayne, Democrats here afraid that Clinton would be handed the nomination without a fight? Isn't this an indication of party unity behind one candidate?
Well, I think maybe a bigger issue here is Clinton has an incredibly strong organization at this stage, and Warren has absolutely no organization. And I think just the size of the Clinton operation, plus the fact that she's run before, plus her overall political experience and all that, deters other people. So I'm not sure it says as much party unity as it says that people think that Clinton is so strong they don't want to challenge her.
Mm-hmm. Jim?
Yeah, I think I have said before, I think a challenge would be good. It would sharpen sort of the debate for Secretary of State Clinton here, former Secretary of State Clinton. So it would be good to occur, but I think Wayne's right. I mean, there is such a kind of massive level of support already, and the donor class and so on is so much behind Clinton that it really makes it difficult for any challenger. I think what even keeping Elizabeth Warren's name alive, or you know, maybe Jim Webb or somebody else, is that if in fact Clinton would have a problem that, you know, if Benghazi or some of these things or that email would really rise to the level that she would be very tarnished, then I think they want to have another candidate, or another candidate might be willing to step in. I think that's pretty doubtful, but that's the only plausible way I think that some of these other candidates could have a prospect of derailing Clinton.
Another perspective from someone who wrote in this letter to Elizabeth Warren to challenge Hillary Clinton. An interesting quote here. If we end up with a single Democratic candidate and little to no debate in the primaries, those of us unlikely to support a Republican nominee will be left voting for a Democrat who may be opposed to the Republican agenda, but is not necessarily a champion of the vision of change that millions of us seek and that this country needs. So there, we talk often about the factions within the GOP, but there are, Wayne, factions within the Democrats as well.
Yeah, I think one risk is that Democrats wouldn't come out to vote. There are some people who might be excited by a challenger, and even if the challenger lost, would come out to vote. I'm thinking people on the left wing of the Democratic Party. If there was a challenger, at least they would have felt they had some input. And then at the time of the election, because they didn't have any input, might just stay away and stay home.
Mm-hmm. Since we've had you on, Ted Cruz declaring his candidacy on the GOP side. As we close here, Jim, your observations about where the two major parties stand in presenting their hopefuls for the White House in 2016?
Well, I think there are going to be over the next couple of weeks a slew of Republicans that are going to announce. I mean, I think that's where we're at. Ted Cruz got out front. He's been able to raise some money, get some publicity here. I suppose, in one sense, you'd have to say he's a front runner because he's the only runner at this juncture. But I think what we're going to see over the next several weeks here, at least there have been the hint of these other Republican candidates announced. I think on the Republican side, that field will become a little clearer of who's really going to be in a competitive race.
Let's talk about this briefly. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley quietly kicking off his campaign for a seventh term, a country club fundraiser in West Des Moines on Monday. He's serving his 35th year in the Senate.
Wow.
Yeah, we know he's been in there a long time, but when you really think about it, 35 years, he's widely popular in Iowa. We can illustrate that with what he's always elected between around 60+% of the vote, isn't he, Jim?
That's right. Yes, I think last time he got 63% of the vote.
Right.
So suppose it was supposed to be a bit of a competitive race, but he's been up also in the low 70s as well when a sort of a lesser known candidate ran against him.
And ascending to the height of his power, now chairing the powerful Judiciary Committee, the ranking third in the chamber in seniority overall in the Senate. Wayne Moyer, can you imagine anyone in the Democratic Party giving him a serious run for his seventh term?
I think it would be an absolutely enormous challenge. The only way that I could really see it being successful is if something absolutely unknown at this stage of the game came up in terms of, I think it would be mostly in terms of his own health or something like that. I think otherwise he's going to be very, very difficult to beat.
Mm-hmm. Okay. A minute or so left.
I mean, the biggest thing, it seems to me, is that a challenger would have so much difficulty raising money, it seems to me. I guess that says something about our political process, mm-hmm. or maybe a lot about our political process.
Other political observation stories that didn't get mentioned this hour that you've got your eye on, Wayne or Jim?
Well, I'm still watching Ukraine pretty closely. I'm not sure this ceasefire is very stable, and attention is turned toward the Middle East at the moment, but it could turn back there very quickly.
Mm-hmm. With developments there, is the civil war still continuing?
I think they're still firing back and forth, and there is, I think, some fear that the rebels may, when they're resupplied, try to expand further.
Jim McCormick, other political stories you're watching?
Well, I think that mostly it's been focused on the Iranian agreement is what really has garnered my attention here. So I and the whole Middle East has really been the focal point for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if this agreement comes, this is an interim agreement or an initial agreement. That just means what, a framework with details to be worked out?
Well, now I guess the Iranians want an understanding, and they can get the final agreement by June. I mean, that is the that's really the design that that is in place for these kind of talks here. I'm still skeptical that we're going to get there.
Okay, supposing we do, though, then it goes to our Congress for ratification by the Senate?
It's not quite clear whether it'll be a formal treaty. It might just be something to send for an up or down vote to both houses of Congress. But I'll come back to the point I made earlier. If it is too general and not enough T's are crossed and I's are dotted, I think it's going to be problematic.
Okay. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Jim McCormick, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Thank you both for lending us your expertise this hour.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Tomorrow on this program, what is it like to work for the CIA, to be a spy? How has work in the field of clandestine operations and intelligence gathering changed over the past century? Tomorrow on this program, and spending the whole hour with Tom Twetten, he's worked undercover for decades as an intelligence officer for the CIA from 61 until 95. We'll talk with him tomorrow about all kinds of things. He's speaking tomorrow at Iowa State University. Tomorrow we'll have him on the program to talk about the business of espionage. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth. Also thanks to Julia Davis. Jason Burns helped us out in Ames. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.